Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Boy.
Some call it plagiarism, others call it inspiration. But in the world of copyright law, there may be a third option. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, we look at the doctrine known as fair use. Plus, director Peter Sellers joins us with a new musical based on Shakespeare's heroine, Desdemona. We'll hear a live performance from cast members. But we begin with fair use, the idea that artists, DJs, and others can use a limited amount of copyrighted material to create new work. The latest music video from this pop diva, Beyoncé, is inspiring still more debate on the issue. And joining me today to tell us why is the author Patricia Aufderheide. Her new book is called Reclaiming Fair Use: How to Put Balance Back in Copyright. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Pat, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thank you.
So this Beyoncé video for the song Countdown, why is this inspiring debate today?
Well, Beyoncé has a number of dance moves in that video that another choreographer, a feminist choreographer, in Belgium, had claims are moves that she had developed a long time ago and that Beyoncé just copied them. And it is actually true that Beyoncé looked at her work and admired it and incorporated some of those moves into this video. But the artist is actually not claiming that she violated copyright. What the artist is claiming is that she was rude. and she said you didn't acknowledge me. But worse than that, from the Belgian artist's perspective, is
this
that
is Anna
Belgian...
Theresa de Kirschmacher, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad you said that. Good. That woman's name is as challenging to me as Aufderheide is to the rest of us. But what she's basically saying is, look, I did that, and I did it within a feminist context, and you're Beyoncé, and you don't look feminist to me at all. So this is one of those cases where copyright, which is one set of issues, gets dragged into an issue in which people are really talking about etiquette and politics.
Mm.
This is a familiar issue among artists. Susan Mizellis and another artist whose name is Joyce something, I can find out in a minute, had a big and public dispute because Susan Mizellis is a political photographer, took a picture in Nicaragua. This woman incorporated her work into another work, and Susan wasn't really upset that her work had been used because Susan was eager to see her work widely used in a revolutionary context. She was not happy to see it used out of its revolutionary context. So you see people sort of invoking copyright in a sloppy way when what they really want to say is, you hurt my feelings.
Now, you can, Anna Theresa de Kirschmacher, in theory, could copyright her dance. I mean, you can't copyright a move any more than you can copyright a chord or a brief fragment of a melody in a song, right?
Right. The letter C belongs to the world. Yes.
So does
a wave.
Right. Now, if you do have copyright on something you've created, a dance, a song, a poem, a photograph, whatever it is, what is the doctrine of fair use? How does that enable other people to use your work?
Oh, and I'm so glad you asked. The whole point of copyright is to be able to enable people to encourage people to make more stuff. The government wants everybody to make more culture. It's really good for the economy. It's good for the culture. Culture keeps a culture alive. Renewing that culture makes it grow. Good thing. So one way to do that is to give people a little carrot if they make something. That's a limited monopoly. But another way to encourage people to make culture is to give people access to the existing culture. Now, the old way of doing that was just to not give people much of a limited monopoly over that stuff. Copyright wasn't too long. It didn't apply to very many things, and it didn't apply to many derivatives. That really has changed in the last 30 years. We've gotten a much more unbalanced copyright. And so suddenly the features that let you get at copyright that's still under limited monopoly, and that's mostly fair use, becomes very important. And fair use basically says if you are making something new, if you are adding something to the existing material that's under limited monopoly, mm-hmm. if you are doing something to it that adds value to it, either you are using it in a different context or you are using it a limited amount of it in order to make a new thing, and you use the appropriate amount, and that appropriate amount, by the way, could even be 100% in some cases. So if you have a transformative use, you aren't just downloading the Beyonce song because you love Beyonce. You're making some point about Beyonce, and then you're using as much of the song as you want to use. There's a video on your website, actually, that clips out some aspects of Beyonce's video and then clips out some aspects of the Belgian choreographer's video.
Kirschmacher,
and then compares the two, and they don't take all of the video of both of them.
Right.
This video only takes the clips that will help you understand the contrast. That is a terrific example on your website of fair use.
And this is something we see all the time. For example, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. I mean, clip after clip, which they haven't gone to Fox News or any of those other places to clear the rights. It's used under this doctrine of fair use.
So Rick Perry was just having some fun, and he's not the only Republican candidate out there with a sense of humor. Here's Herman Cain explaining why he said he wanted an electrified fence across the Mexican border.
Let me first say it was a joke, and some people don't think that it was a good joke, and it's probably not a joke that you're supposed to make if you're a presidential candidate. I apologize if it offended anyone.
By the way, if you enjoyed Cain's routine, you can catch more of his comedy stylings on the next Tone Deaf Comedy Jam. Now, Cain apologizes for the joke about electrifying the fence, says one more sentence, and then says this.
I don't apologize for using a combination of a fence, and it might be electrified. I'm not walking away from that.
Herman Cain proposes policy the same way a teenager.
That is Jon Stewart from The Daily Show, and again, using a couple of these clips of Herman Cain under the doctrine of fair use. Patricia Auferheide is co-author of Reclaiming Fair Use, How to Put Balance Back in Copyright. And Pat, one of the kind of creative licenses that allows you to use this fair use doctrine is parody, right?
Parody is one of many, many examples of ways in which you might transform the original material. Mm-hmm. Yeah, remix is another, quotation for criticism or commentary is another. There's the doctrine of fair use is deliberately written in a very expansive and abstract way so that when you need to use material that's not in some prescribed way or something that a lawyer could already think of, you won't be inhibited in mm-hmm. your uses because somebody didn't pre-approve it for you.
All right. Now, the thing with fair uses, I think people will be surprised at how close to home this is. We're not just talking about a doctrine that's used by, you know, TV celebrities, by superstar musicians and dancers, by composers and remixers. We're talking about something that you use if you're helping your local PTA put together a flyer or, you know, I mean, it's just if you have a TiVo or a VCR at home, you are a beneficiary of this fair use doctrine.
Absolutely. In fact, the entire consumer electronics industry is because they get to make those VCRs because of it.
Now, we've taken a couple of your questions and put together a fair use pop quiz for our listeners. Go to our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. You will see three scenarios, and three questions for you about what you think, whether this is covered by fair use or not. And we'll get the answers from Pat in a little while. But go to the webpage and check that out, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And if you have a blog or a fan site, you know, or are a remixer, you have to deal with fair use as well. And if you've had some experience with this, if you have an opinion about what fair use is fair and fair to both you and to the copyright holder, Or if you have a question for Pat After Heidi, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692, or leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Pat's with us on the line from Washington, D.C., and joining me in the studio is the filmmaker David Van Taylor. His work includes Dream Deceivers and A Perfect Candidate. He's also vice president of the production company Lumiere Productions. And David, what has your experience with fair use been?
My experience with fair use ranges from the horrific to the fantastic. But the horrific is only back in the dark old days when I was relatively ignorant about fair use, as were many of us. First of all, I want to mention, because I think it's very important to people's understanding, that fair use has been part of copyright law from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that was added on as a corrective. It was always understood by the people who created copyright's limited monopoly that you needed exceptions to that in order to preserve the First Amendment value of free speech. I learned about this the hard way starting in 1988 when I started making a film about two young men who shot themselves in Reno, Nevada, and their parents decided that they had been subliminally mesmerized by messages in the music of Judas Priest, the heavy metal band. I went to great lengths and spent a lot of money that I didn't have to clear clips from all kinds of Judas Priest songs, not only from their recordings and live performances that I was allowed to film, but even from their court appearances. And I think maybe we have a...
I think that is what we have, in fact. So you went and cleared all these things,
exactly.
not realizing that they may or that there was this fair use doctrine that might have covered you.
Exactly.
All right. This is one of the clips from that film, which eventually came out in 1990.
Right. 92.
Called Dream Deceivers by David Van Taylor.
Better by you, better than me. You can say what I only can see.
Thank you. Is the exhalation of breath?
Yes.
Is that a normal part of your singing?
That's the way I've always sung. That's just my style.
Is there some effect has for the aesthetics of the song?
It's just the way it's performed, the emotion involved, the feeling that you give out when you're singing it.
Are there subliminal duets on the Better By You, Better Than Me song?
Absolutely not.
I heard the word do it, the words do it, but I didn't understand in what context or why it was there. I identified approximately seven of them. It's very difficult because it is the subliminal level.
So someone is demonstrating here how the words do it are subliminally hidden in this song by Judas Priest.
Exactly.
So now, what did you clear here?
It was the prevailing opinion of any number of lawyers that I spoke with, and certainly with the lawyers for Sony Music who owned Judas Priest recordings, which didn't come into play in that scene, but the people who own the publishing rights which I think was a subsidiary of EMI, owned the publishing rights to Judas Priest compositions, that every time those songs came into play in this movie in any way, shape, or form, I needed to license them and pay them for those uses, whether it was Rob Halford on the stand singing or whether it was this guy playing it backwards, and it's kind of crazy, but that was the prevailing opinion at the time.
Pat, Patricia After Heidi, this sounds like the Dark Ages. Was film late in arriving, to the idea of fair use?
Well, I think that certainly the studios were not late in arriving to fair use. The studios always did and always do very vigorously employ their right here. They use it every day, and they know the law very well, and that's why they use it. It's independent filmmakers, and it's individuals. It's the woman who's making the PTA flyer who are often confused, often because they confuse what the industry is warning you about downloading, all of those messages about how don't steal, and combined with all the messages we ever got in grade school about don't copy. But they mix that up with their rights on fair use. So there's been a lot of miseducation, a lot of discouragement, and a lot of overcautious behavior that's made it very difficult. One of the reason why David really had that change of understanding is that he participated in creating a code of best practices that filmmakers did in order to educate themselves about what was possible for them under fair use. Fair use is so abstract, and it's so general. You know, gee, make something new in the world, contribute to the world in some way that you to this material and only use as much as you need. Sounds great until you realize you could face statutory penalties of potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars if you guess wrong.
So David, now having been kind of steeped in the practice of fair use, in the doctrine of fair use, right, if you had it to do over again, would anything that we just heard from your documentary have been licensed?
No. Not only would it not have been licensed, I would never have asked the people who hold the rights to those publications, those songs or those recordings. It doesn't need to be an issue. And that's one aspect of fair use that needs to be clear. It's not a question of now going out and getting permission to fair use something. It's a question of, doing what you need to do,
right,
as long as it is within the guidelines of fair use and making your work.
So I guess the key quote there is within the guidelines of fair use. And Pat, this is what you were saying before, that those guidelines are kind of elastic, it seems. And if you guess wrong, you can be in serious hot water.
Right, and yet judges are incredibly, incredibly in love with fair use. They bend over backwards to honor fair use claims. So the litigation history is very, very small. You know, companies like Viacom, which routinely employ fair use, for instance, in The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, know the law, and so they're not going to sue. Mm-hmm. Over a fair use that's legitimate, or even within the general range of legitimate, because they don't want to publicize the utility of this doctrine.
But they're not afraid to hype that. Sorry, they're not afraid to threaten to sue.
That is absolutely.
And there are a lot of
the sense of danger that people feel may not be really, it may not be an accurate risk assessment, but they feel it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So when the documentary filmmakers created a code of best practices, they did something that was it was really revolutionary. People had not been doing this, and what they basically said is here's four very common situations we have, and here's how we understand fair use within those situations. Then they had it reviewed by a bunch of lawyers. The lawyers didn't set the terms. The lawyers just made sure that they were within the law.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened almost immediately was that the industry changed. They need insurance, and the insurers, who really have no sense of humor and no particular interest in art and are only interested in risk, said, sure, we'll insure you for claims against copyright infringement if you use fair use within the terms of your own mm-hmm. code of best practices.
All right, so coming up with that code was a way of kind of demarcating, these may be very elastic, but this is where we're choosing to kind of draw the lines. So
right, and the courts, and that's right. That was something the community of documentary filmmakers did, and all of these critical gatekeepers and the courts have really accepted it, and it has transformed everything.
All right, we're speaking with the filmmaker David Van Taler, who's actually been working lately on a 6-part documentary on documentaries. And Patricia Aufderheide, co-author of Reclaiming Fair Use, How to Put Balance Back in Copyright. In a moment, we will continue our conversation about this complicated doctrine that does have, implications for all of us. We'll get the answers to the Fair Use Pop Quiz. The questions are on our webpage. And all of that is coming up.
If you want it, you can get it. If you want it, I'ma hit it. Flip it, rub it up and smack it. Look back at it, I'ma add it.
Oh, there are so many samples being used under the what the artist hopes will be the safety umbrella of fair use. This is the one-man band known as Girl Talk. So we continue our discussion about fair use in a moment, and then later on the show, a sneak peek at the new Toni Morrison take on Shakespeare's Othello. Director Peter Sellers and the cast of Desdemona join us for a live performance on Soundcheck.
Bounce back. Jim, your boy's back.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Once upon a time, the Beatles did the White Album, and then Jay-Z did the Black Album, and then the DJ known as Danger Mouse mashed them up in the Gray Album. We're hearing a little bit of that in the background. Fair use might not have given him the protection he needed to release this commercially, so it never was commercially released. We continue our discussion of the thorny patch of copyright law known as fair use. We're speaking with the author Patricia Aufderheide, co-author of the new book Reclaiming Fair Use, Putting the Balance Back in Copyright, and the filmmaker David Van Taylor, who's been instrumental in putting together a kind of best practices for the use of this doctrine in the film industry. And we got a call from Victor, who was driving and didn't want to stay on the line and very sensibly just left us his question, Pat. What should bloggers and other website owners know about linking out to other sites or about quoting from news sources on other blogs?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you for that question. And we are actually at the Center for Social Media in January. We'll be releasing a major report that we've been researching all year on journalists and their fair use rights, and in particularly in a blogging environment. Journalists have not yet done what filmmakers have done in establishing a journalistic code of best practices around fair use. But in general, those two basic questions will be very, very helpful to Victor. What is your reason for wanting to quote that material? Linking is just forget it. Linking is fine. Linking is non-controversial. But what about when you want to quote some of that material in your own blog post? How much should you quote? You should be asking yourself, how does this quote add value to the original material? Am I commenting on it? Am I inviting commentary by others on it? Or am I just plopping it there so that people don't have to go back to the other site, which would not only be rude, it would be infringing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's the, and then the second question leads right from the first one, which is how much do I need to make that point? And so long as you're making those sensible decisions, you are doing something that is both ethical and legal.
All right. Well, that's I guess that's as much of an answer as Victor is going to get right now, because as you say, you're going to be working on this at the Center for Social Media in a couple of months, right?
Working. We can also certainly say that anybody who tells him 400 words is okay is creating far too many limitations on this very flexible and useful part of copyright law.
All right. We've got a question for you from David, who is on the line with us from Princeton, New Jersey. David, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. How you doing?
If this doctrine covers parody, and now I'm not exactly positive, but doesn't Weird Al Yankovic have to pay royalties to the original artist?
Big L is a great example of the confusion about fair use. He actually he knows he has fair use rights, by the way, to make fun of and indeed make parodies of their work. He contacts all the original producers of that material and asks permission. And I believe that he has said his real motivation there is that he believes that that is the polite thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
He could invoke his fair use rights to do the very same thing. Many people, parody is, as I said, one of many, many ways that fair use can be invoked.
Can I throw in a thought here? I'm a fan of Weird Al. I'm also a fan of Susan Mizellis and Anna Teresa de Kirchmacher. But as soon as the rights holder says to you, which they usually say in my experience sort of under their breath as if it were a throwaway at the end of the conversation, this isn't going to make me look bad, is it? As soon as they say that, that's when you know you really are exercising your fair use rights, because that is precisely the central case that fair use is intended to prevent from happening. Copyright is not supposed to stifle your free speech rights mm-hmm. to criticize anybody. And normally it's not the feminist Belgian dancer or the feminist photographer who's trying to stifle those rights. Normally it's very large corporations who want to make sure that, you know, we don't occupy Wall Street or whatever, which gives me one opportunity also to say that we've rebranded the fair use movement. We're now calling it Occupy Copyright.
Well, there's copyright, there's copyleft, there's creative commons. There's such a thicket of competing ideas out there.
And fair use is really the most moderate and almost conservative, I would say, of those. And it should not be controversial.
Well, and Pat, the title of your book, Reclaiming Fair Use, How to Put Balance Back in Copyright, it is a balancing act, right? I mean, people who are creative deserve to have some ability to, you know, make a living off of their creativity.
That's right. And I think the more people who come into the pool of active creators, the more we see how valuable people's own limited monopoly rights are to them. Every single time somebody in a news agency takes one of those twit pics that somebody posted on Twitter and uses it in a news story, and then the guy who originally took the picture says, wait a second, that's mine. Weren't you supposed to pay me? You can see that just because people are creating in a digital and a social environment does not mean that they don't think they have some rights to that material. So I think that is a very real, and a right that we have to acknowledge that people think is very valuable. It's certainly not going away.
All right.
At the same time, you need to have the balancing features that let you have access to that same copyrighted material when you have other things to do with it other than its market purpose.
Right. So recreating, remixing. We're getting a lot of calls and comments, Pat, sort of asking variations on this question of, you know, sampling, remixing, reproducing, reconstituting mm-hmm. pre-existing artwork. So I'm going to give Nick a chance to frame the question. He's calling in from Brooklyn. Nick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say, you know, it was interesting that you put up the Beatles' Grey album, you know, with Jay-Z. The Beatles were, in fact, in 1966, some of the first people to use sampling themselves, using found source material on tape loops in Tomorrow Never Knows, for instance,
right.
And then Revolution Number 9. So I think, you know, bands like the Beatles would have been really, really cool with this if they were still around to hear it.
If they wouldn't, they should have been.
Yeah, that might be more the case. So what about that, Pat? I mean, where do we go with sampling? How much is fair use?
Yeah, that's what everybody would like to know. And fair use was deliberately designed to be abstract and general so that people would not be inhibited in saying, well, I can only use 3 seconds. I can only use mm-hmm. 2 chords. So that they would say, what do I really need? And in general, what has happened in fair use is that the communities that have asserted their fair use rights have, in practice, have much more fair use than those that haven't.
So as with all the arts, it's a question of how far you can push the envelope before you break through, I guess. Pat, we have to get going here. So I just want to very quickly get the answers of our fair use pop quiz. Number one, the PTA flyer. You're making a flyer for your local PTA's book fair, and you want to reproduce some book covers to decorate it. You're going to send this flyer around to your email list and post it on the school website. Is that okay?
Right, and the answer would be yes, those are copyrighted images. Now, Scholastic might have given you permission to use them, in which case you can set copyright aside. But if you need to make your own decision about it, what you'll say is, What purpose am I quoting these materials for? Well, this is the PTA book fair. These are going to be examples and illustrations. You have an illustrative reason that is a fair use reason, and you're only using as much as is needed to get the job done to tell people about it. So you're done. You're fine.
All right. Then there's the YouTube video and the music curricula, and you can find those answers to the pop quiz on our webpage at wnyc.org/soundcheck. We've been discussing the topic of fair use and copyright with David Van Taler, filmmaker, who's currently in the midst of a 6-part documentary about documentaries, and Patricia Aufderheide, co-author of the new book Reclaiming Fair Use, How to Put Balance Back in Copyright. A little bit from James Brown's funky drummer Clyde Stubblefield in the background. And David, Pat, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky?
That is one of the most sampled breaks in all of music, Clyde Stubblefield's drumming there. Still to come, a live performance in the studio from Rokia Traore and the cast of Desdemona. That's next on Soundcheck.